Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here with someone who didn't take no for an answer. He had a lot of talent and did not have an easy way to the top, but I believe he was the first artist ever to sell a million records from TV and promoting himself on TV. He'll correct me if I'm wrong, but what a splash he made, and he just refused to take no for an answer. His name is Peter Lemongello, and he started out on Long Island, so all you Long Islanders that might be listening, this is one of our own, and he has absolutely made us all proud by, again, stick-to-itiveness and talent. And talent has a lot to do with it, too. A great singer. Peter Lemongello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
Well, listen, it's true, right? You were the first guy really that I remember. I was a kid when it was happening, and we were so proud of you because you lived around the corner from me growing up, and we heard about you, and you were a legend in the neighborhood, and everybody was talking about you. But it really, you were the guy that broke through on TV the first time.
Yeah, I don't think anyone else ever launched their career as an unknown on TV and broke that way. I know my reason for doing it was simple. I had been at it for many years, and I had some success, and I got teased a few times, but I didn't get to where I wanted to go. I did a couple of Tonight shows, and I was able to get a couple of the other talk shows at the time. Mike Douglas was one of them, Merv Griffin, but I wasn't getting anywhere. Eventually, in 1973, I signed with Epic Records, and that could have launched my career in a conventional way, like any of the other artists that you know. But they didn't push the record, and then a year later, they dropped me. And although that's common, when you are with a major label and then you get dropped, it's even more difficult to end up finding another major label that's willing to take a chance with you. So I had a couple of years that were very, very frustrating. And eventually I got the idea to circumvent the industry completely and to do what I did, which was I made my own album, I made my own TV commercial, and I bought my own airtime.
Wow.
My purpose was, I had a lot of reasons behind it, because I felt this was a way for me to get directly to the public. And if they liked me and bought me, then I not only proved to the industry that I was worthy of a career, but I could dispel the doubt. Now, if they didn't like me and didn't buy my albums, then I would understand and I'd accept it. The truth is, I never expected to sell over a million albums, and nobody that was involved with me did either. The success we had was shockingly glorious. You know, we were happy with the results, obviously, but the purpose I originally intended for it was to make a mark, to get myself famous and end up with a career. And it led to all kinds of things like Lincoln Center, Westbury Music Fair, Madison Square
Garden,
Carnegie Hall. I was almost going to forget that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
One of the highlights of my life. I got to tell you something, Frank. When you are starting out and you, obviously, it's very hard to get a decent venue to work in when you're just starting. It's very tough to get friends, family, and people to come and see you. But when you're working Carnegie Hall, they can't wait to get there.
Yeah. Wow. You know, wow.
Madison Square Garden, Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center. That was really easy.
Jeez. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's really a unique thing to do. Nowadays, I mean, like people record in their basements and everything else. What kind of recording budget did you start out with? I mean, did you go somewhere locally? You were on Long Island, right? For the most part, you were on Long Island?
Yes, but Let me explain how that happened.
Yeah.
Trying to put a package like that together is really, when I look back on it, a tremendous amount of work. I mean, aside from, I'll answer your question about the album in a second, but trying to understand how much is involved. If you're involved with a record company, they do everything for you. If you're on your own, you make an album, you end up with a tape, you have to bring it to a pressing plant and get all of that, you know, get them mothered and ready to press. You have to get a printer and somebody to make, to glue the printing onto the album covers. I mean, it's really an extensive amount of work. But it was a labor of love. I mean, I enjoyed every minute of it. And I was so young that the hard work didn't bother me. Today it would be overwhelming. But anyway, we didn't have a big budget. We allocated $10,000 to make the album, which is almost impossible to do.
Yeah.
Truth is, I ended up along the way meeting a sax player named Joe Grimaldi. His stage name is Joe Grim. And he knew Teddy Randazza. And he said to me, Teddy had hit records with Little Anthony and the Imperials, Hurt So Bad, Going Out of My Head, and a couple of others. So he said, Teddy's got new material, perfect for this era, the disco era that we were in. He said, and he's interested. So I went up and I went to his house in Nyack. We met. We really hit it off musically and even developed a friendship. And I loved all the songs that he had written. And so he understood the situation. He called on every friend of his who was a musician. He had a friend who had a recording studio in Nyack. And believe it or not, we put the studio album together with, 38 musicians on almost every song, and five singers. But the five singers were Teddy, his wife, Vicky, Bobby Weinstein, who co-wrote the songs with Teddy, and a couple of other people. And so we put the whole thing together, and it was really fabulous work. The album came out so well. And we did it for the 10,000. That's almost a miracle.
Yeah.
Even then, it was 1975 when we recorded it, December of 75.
You realize if we were watching this on a big screen in a movie theater, people would say, come on. Yeah, what are you talking about? You actually did this. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. If you're just joining us or if you're turning on your radios a little late, Frank McKay here. Much more importantly, Peter Lemongello, a very talented guy, but a story really of just perseverance, just an amazing career that he put together. And again, he didn't like the way the industry was going for him, and he decided to go at it himself, and he launched a TV campaign, sold a million records on TV, the first to do anything like that, an unknown breaking himself through TV commercials. I mean, it's just absolutely mind blowing what he did, and you don't. You really don't realize how incredible that is unless you really knew the history. And here we are, Peter Lemongello, getting the history. Frank McKay here with Peter. Peter, what did Epic have as a reaction, if any, once you sold the million records, once they realized, you know, you're a hit? Did they reach back to you? Did they re-release their record?
But what's funny is that when we had this enormous success, and the people, I'll go back just a second, the people who we found to place the media company, it was called Triad Media, who there were two girls that owned it, had experience in buying TV commercials, went out on their own. They believed in me so much that they worked really hard to make sure we got the best mileage, dollar for dollar. That's why we were able to buy 100 spots a week on New York television at first. We branched into other markets. But when we did that, I said to them, you think people will know who I am? She said, one of them said, you won't be able to walk the streets. You won't believe how popular you're going to get. And it's comical because I had a cousin that lived in Jersey. And he said that on Friday, he was a complete unknown. My commercial started Saturday morning. He said, by Monday morning, I was famous.
Wow. Wow.
He said, I went to school. He says, you know him? He says, my cousin. Oh, my God. So we had, you know, it really skyrocketed, and it was a wonderful experience. But no, and my ambition was to end up with a major label, which I did, Private Stock Records, who had Frankie Valli and Walter Murphy and David Soul and several other people on their label. And that was my ambition because I broke on TV and I circumvented the industry and pulled the stunt that made it work for me. But then I wanted to have a conventional career. I wanted to concentrate on my music and my performances and let the record company do all the underwriting and distribution and promotion. So it did work out for me that way, but not from Epic. They didn't bite again. What's comical about it, though, is that 60 Minutes did a piece on it, and they interviewed everybody. The press agent I had at the time, you know, that I used to promote media for me, and they went back to Epic Records. They went back to the William Morris Agency and asked the president what he thought, and this is really comical. He said, well, I'll tell you the truth. He said, you can't. If you're going to go on TV 100 times a week, you got to get famous. He said, so I'm not surprised. But the truth is, I met him before I did it, and I told him about it, and he said, you're nuts. This will never work. And I said, well, wait a minute. So you can't sell records as an unknown on TV. I said, well, if I go on 100 times a week, aren't people going to relate to me for my own commercial, and then I wouldn't be unknown to them? Well, he didn't buy it. But then when it was on 60 Minutes, he kind of took credit for it.
Wow. You know,
and Epic Records did the same thing. They went back to the president of Epic, and he said, no, he says, you know, you make mistakes. He said, he's very good, and the people love him. He said, but when we had him, we didn't see it that way, you know?
You want to know something funny? I grew up, and I think when I reached out to you, I put this in there, but I grew up on Kenneth Lane. Now, I was born in 1967, so I was a little kid. And we heard about you. You lived next door, or your mom lived next door. I think you grew up next
door. No, we lived on Jane Drive, which was back-to-back with Kenneth Lane.
Right, and you lived next door to my first grade and my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. McSquiggan. And I don't know if you remember her?
You poor thing.
She lived to 99 years old. And, she unbelievable. Yeah, she...
Well, that doesn't see the good die young, and that proves...
Oh, no. Did she give you a hard time growing up? Was she one of those...
God, yes.
That's unbelievable.
We grew up thinking that she and her husband didn't like kids. What kind of people don't like kids would become school teachers, you know? But of all things. But we had nothing. We never got along.
That's unbelievable, right? So you live next door to her. We heard about you from TV. I was a kid. When did these commercials start? Were they
76? January of 1976.
So I was 9 years old. We bought the record, and then we heard, after we bought the damn record, we found out that you lived around the corner, or that you used to live around the corner, and we knocked on your door. My brother and I was a 9 year old kid, and my brother was 11, and we knocked on like idiots. And you were great. You were gracious. You signed it. You were very nice. You remember people coming to your door?
Yes, I in those days, whenever I could, even though I had grown up and moved out. At the time I lived in Islip, my mother still lived on Jane Drive.
Yeah.
And so whenever I could, I would go on a say on a Sunday because she made really great meatballs and macaroni on Sundays. And so when I got famous, she would have a list. She'd say, you know, all the kids in the neighborhood come to the door. So I take their names. They all want pictures and autographs. But once they saw my car, they flocked to the door, so it got to be an hour of my visit to my mother and father. I ended up signing autographs, but I loved it. I mean, when you're an unknown and you're rejected all over the place, I can't see how anybody who gets famous wouldn't enjoy the reversal of being rejected, you know?
Just amazing. Yeah, and you were gracious, and but, I mean, to us, you were larger than life. You were Sinatra to us. and we're hearing that you live around the block, and we're saying, is this possible? Could this guy have... And they said, yeah. Somebody said, yeah, he did. And then somebody said, you live next door to Mrs. McSquiggan of of all things, which is insane. Frank McKay here, much more importantly, Peter Lemangelo, who, by the way, his son is a great singer as well. I mean, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, and he's done some TV and American Idol and in all kinds of things, and we'll talk to him sometime in the future. We'll be talking to Peter's son. And but right now, Peter Lemangelo, again, just an amazing. This is a movie. This should be a movie. And what a career he put together. And he just refused to say no, and take no for an answer. And the industry tried to shut him out. He went on TV with commercials, 100 commercials a week, and sold a million records. I mean, think about it. What did the whole process cost you? If you don't forget about the recording, we know that cost 10 grand. But what did the marketing budget cost you?
Well, the initial, that's interesting, because now once you make the album and you're geared up to reproduce them, now you have to figure out how you're going to get it to the public. So my idea was TV. We met these people from the who had a media company. And they structured the first month of commercials, 100 a week, 100 commercials a week. And don't forget, in those days, there were only six channels.
Yeah.
There was CBS, NBC, ABC, WNEW, WOR, and WPIX. That was it. Not like today, there's 1,000 stations. But anyway, they structured the first 4 weeks for $60,000, $15,000 a week.
Wow.
And that was going to be it. In other words, it was. I was going to shoot the load right there. We had only about 80,000 when we started, so we blew 10 on the album, and we spent 10 on the album, and we had other expenses to reproduce the records and photography and all that. So we had 60 left, and we went, and I said to the guys who were backing me, I said, look, if we sell, we parlay it into staying on. If we don't sell, then we gave it our best shot and we go home. And we sold enough in the first month to continue. By the second month, it went right through the roof and we had no problem. We just rolled the money every time we earned it. But it got to be a tremendous amount of money because we sold an unprecedented amount of records that even I, to this day, find hard to believe.
It's mind-blowing. Absolutely mind-blowing what you did. And it's just, you know, to roll the $80,000 in 1976. I mean, our house, the house on Kenneth Lane, we sold in, I think, 79 for $32,000, right? That my parents sold it for $32,000. A couple years later, it was worth
it. My parents bought it for $11,990, if you can believe that.
Wow.
In the 50s.
That is unbelievable. I assume you went to Woods Road School, right? Grammar school?
All of them. Belmont Avenue School, Woods Road.
Peter J. Brennan or Robert Moses?
No, let me think. Well, my junior high and high school are on Deer Park Avenue.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, but there was Woods Road. There was Bailey Street. There was just so many one-story schoolhouses that we went. They're big.
Yeah.
But they were, and each year it seemed like they would build another one and we would transfer from one to the other. Woods Road, I went to in the sixth grade.
Up till sixth grade probably, right?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm just remembering this now, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but Mark Lemangelo was a professional bowler. Is that right?
No, that's my brother, Mike.
Mike Lemangelo. Okay, Mike.
Who is a Hall of Fame. Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, he won the U.S. Open and six major titles on the PBA Tour and 300 games that were sanctioned. So he had success before I did. This was really funny because I was thrilled for my brother. I was always his biggest fan. And then I happened... And my mother, God rest her soul, she got hit from both sides. Everywhere she went, nobody would believe that both her sons were the Lemangelos. You know, she would go to present her credit card at a department store. And the lady said, you know, there's a singer by that name. She said, yeah, that's my son. But there's a bowler by that. She goes, that's my other son. Oh, nobody would believe her.
Again, it's still unbelievable. Let me remind folks once again, Peter Lemangelo is our very special guest, and very proud to say that I was a 9-year-old kid knocking on his door around the corner from our house. I mean, just amazing. I mean, I could throw a rock from my house and Kenneth Lane over the thing and hit his house. Just absolutely amazing what he did, though. Sold a million copies of his album on TV. TV commercials just refused to take no for an answer.
Actually, just for laughs, it was 1,800,000.
No way. Oh, my God. Almost 2 million. That's
And we got bootlegged, and we have no idea how many we really sold, because when you get hot, the people in the pressing plants steal terribly from you. All the distributors make deals with the guys in the pressing plants. So we really don't know how many were actually sold. But,
well, let me remind folks, too, that just stepped away, Frank McKay here, and you tuned in to Breaking It Down. Much more importantly, our very special guest is Peter Lemangelo. And, again, just a great singer. His son's a great singer, and we'll be talking to him sometime in the future. And right now,
you're going to hear from Peter Jr., I'm telling you.
Yeah, I've been listening to him. I've been listening to him on YouTube since, this. He's great. Oh, this guy's, I'm telling you, you're great. This kid's better. Kid's better than you, and you're
Thank
great.
Thank you. I agree.
Yeah.
He is a heck of a performer, too.
Let's talk a little bit about your parents. They produced a Hall of Fame bowler. And a guy who sold 1.8 million records on his own. I mean, just, with a marketing scheme. And by the way, Peter, let's give credit where credit is due. If you weren't any good, you wouldn't have sold a single record. If you could have spent $1 million. But your voice is great. You looked good. You looked like a star and all this. And you packaged it right. The commercial was right, and you just did it. So, I mean, your parents, what the hell did they do? What did they do right?
I lost my father when I was 9, and my mother remarried when I was 16. So, and they remained at 12 Jane Drive. My mother was probably more flabbergasted than anybody else, because, we had a really close family. We all loved each other. We all co-inhabited so well together. And then Mike and I went on our own. And he had success on the PBA tour, and I had success in singing. And it came as a real surprise to my mother. She said, I've been watching The Tonight Show for years, and now all of a sudden I'm watching my son on it, And she said, it's mind-boggling. But she was extremely proud of both of us.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, can't believe it. If you think about it. What did your dad do? And I'm sorry to hear anybody lose their dad at 9. What did your dad do for a living?
He worked as a statistician at the Hartford Fire Insurance Company in Brooklyn, New York. Now, we lived in Jersey City. I was born in Jersey City. And in 1954, we moved, when I was 7, we moved out to Long Island. And then, unfortunately, he contracted a brain tumor and passed away 2 years later.
Wow. That's unbelievable. And Mike is a couple of years older than you? How old is he compared?
He's 2 years older than I am. He lives in Atlantic City now. He's retired from bowling, but not from poker.
Yeah? Oh, all right. So he's...
he's a pretty consistent Texas Hold'em player.
Yeah, it's just wow. When did you notice a difference? And again, I won't get too personal, but financially, when did you notice a difference financially from when you started? Let's say that month you knew you're going to continue on or whatever. When did it start really paying off? And you said, hey, wait, I got a couple bucks here.
Well, I would say by April, we started to realize.
When did you start again?
We started January 15th, 1976. Here's what happens. You have a goal, and you fight to reach the goal. And you don't realize it, but subconsciously, if you reach the goal, the money's going to be right alongside of it. But if you just try to make money, you'll usually fail. You really have to be goal-minded, G-O-A-L.
Yeah.
Not gold-minded. But you have to really fight to do everything that's conceivably necessary to reach the goal. And then all of a sudden, you start to realize, look what happened. You know, there was a reward here that you didn't even expect. I was so caught up with people being so nice to me and being famous and all the attention I got that I never concentrated on the money, not at first anyway. Then I started buying Lincolns and candies. And
yeah. Wow. I mean, just think about this for a second. In 76, obviously that's the bicentennial, right? It was a big deal. But that's the year Rocky came out, right? An Italian guy gets a little break, and then it turns into a huge break, and he makes it happen. You got to be thinking to yourself, hey, this is me, you know? I'm the underdog. If there's an underdog in this world in 1976, it's the guy who couldn't make it work they couldn't make it work for you. Obviously, you made it work on your own. But at Epic and you were getting shut out by the industry in general, and just took it upon yourself. I mean, you had to feel some semblance of a connection with the underdog syndrome going there. It's the bicentennial. Everybody's talking about us, you know, as the underdog, America, and all this. This is the American dream. This is a movie, Peter.
Well, there are people working on that right now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Because they feel it's the Horatio Alger story, all the way from nowhere to somewhere.
Yeah.
And so they're working on that right now. But the point really is, when you're in almost any business, you get kicked in the butt. You know, they don't accept your product. But when you're in show business and they don't accept you, that's a kick in the heart.
Yeah.
Because they're rejecting you. Now, you only have two choices. Quit and go and do something else, or keep fighting until you can break the wall down. And there definitely is a wall up, because almost everybody who starts out in show business as a singer or a comedian faces rejection and opposition right away. And you have to just keep fighting. You really do. I mean, maybe your motivation is success, and maybe it's revenge. I don't know. But the truth is, maybe a little of both.
What did you do prior to all of this? I mean, were you in rock bands? Were you, dabbling with this, dabbling with that? What was your music like in, let's say, high school?
Well, yeah, okay. In high school, I was a drummer in a rock band. I started playing drums when I was 10 or 11, and by about 12 or 13, I was in a rock band, and we were pretty good. It was two guitars and a drum combination. But, we played a couple of weddings, but mostly high school dances and VFW halls and things like that. And I didn't like being a drummer because the guitar player stood in front of me and the cymbals were in front of me and the drums were in front of me, so nobody ever paid attention to me. And then, and we were just a cover rock band, you know, doing all the songs in the 50s and early 60s. Now, when the Beatles hit, everybody started to sing. Mostly we were an instrumental band, like most of the rock bands of the era. When the Beatles hit, everybody started to sing because the Beatles sang. So before you know it, everybody in the band that you're with, by this time we had four or five guys, who can sing here? You know, so we all took turns, and they said, hey, you're pretty good. So I started to sing. But again, even though I was a pretty good singer, maybe even very good, they weren't looking at me because I was behind guitar players and the drums. So I was eager. By the time I was 18, I wanted to step out in front of the drums and try it on my own. And as frustrating as it was also encouraging because I got a good reaction from people. The problem is that the record business had really changed. When I came home from Vietnam in 1968, the music business had really changed. A lot of protest songs and hard rock had started to happen a little bit. The songs that were just not what I was doing. So I was kind of swimming upstream with my style. But I didn't let that, deter me. I just kept trying. You know? Yeah. I mean, I auditioned for the Tonight Show 15 times before I got on.
It's just unbelievable determination.
Nobody can believe it, but in those days, they allowed you to audition if you were a member of... in order for them to pay $320, they had to audition anybody who was a member of AGVA, which is the American Guild of Variety Artists. And if you wanted to go every week at your own expense, bring a piano player and audition, they'd let you do it. And I auditioned over and over again. And kept, they were nice to me, but they never put me on. And eventually, when Fred DeCourter, I don't know if you know that name.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, he produced The Tonight Show.
Yep.
I was working at the Rainbow Grill. I got a really good break. I was working at the Rainbow Grill, which is the 65th floor of the NBC building, and they aired The Tonight Show from the 6th floor. So I called Fred DeCourter, and I said, because I had auditioned so many times, he took the call. And I said, I'm going to be just an elevator ride away. Bring your wife, bring anybody you want. Let me buy you dinner, watch my show. If you don't like me, I'll never bother you again. And he said, okay. And he came up, and in the third song, he gave me the high sign. And 2 days later, I did my first Tonight Show.
What a gig. What a great idea to get a gig in the Rainbow Room.
That's why I wanted it.
Yeah, no doubt.
When I met the guy who booked it, I didn't work for nothing, but I worked for very little. And I said, I don't care what you pay me. I need this because the Tonight Show's, you know, 64 is below me. And I know I've got to be able to get somebody from there up to see me. And I just believed if they saw me in front of an audience, it would be so much better than seeing me audition standing next to a piano in a dead setting in a little room.
Jeez. Yeah, honestly, this is a movie. Let me remind folks, again, that are just joining us a little late. Peter Lemangello is our very special guest, and just an amazing story about a kid from Long Island, North Babylon, sold 1.8 million records on TV. I mean, they shut him out, and he just he came up with a scheme, a plan, and he had a lot of talent, and he just said something in passing that we got to acknowledge here. Frank McKay here, much more importantly, Peter Lemangello. He mentioned coming back from Vietnam. Now, first of all, let me just tell you, the guys who came back from Vietnam – just have a special place in my heart. I mean, they got treated like crap. I mean, absolute crap for no reason at all. And it was the one set of veterans that just we owe so much to as a country. All the vets and all the wars, of course. But anybody that went over to Vietnam and came back here and got, shut out, just shame on us as a nation for letting that happen. But thank you and everybody.
Thank you very much for what you said. I don't know the reason for it, but to show you the extent of it, I mean, I grew up watching Elvis come home from the Army. He wasn't in a war. He was stationed in Germany doing war games.
Right.
And they treated him like a returning hero. And Eddie Fisher before him and, let's say Steve Lawrence, they were all in the service, none of them in a war. And all got treated with such respect. I came home from Vietnam, and it was the exact opposite. We were treated terribly. And wait till you hear this. When I did my first Tonight Show, they said, well, what have you been doing? Well, I hadn't done very much, you know. So I started talking about Vietnam. He says, no, you can't mention Vietnam on the show. I said, why not? He said, well, war is too controversial. He says, we don't want to get involved in that. So I couldn't even mention.
Johnny said that to you? Johnny Cross?
No, this is the talent coordinator who was screening me, you know, because they always do in the afternoon to make up questions, you know, for Johnny to ask you. But that you can bet that was the policy of Carson. He didn't want to touch the war, you know. And that pisses me off because he was a veteran.
Yep. Wow.
So, that's amazing for him to treat, other returning veterans like that. But that's the way it was.
Just amazing. What a shameful time in our...
So instead of it being a benefit for me, it was the exact opposite. I was shunned over it, you know, so...
Wow. How long were you in Vietnam?
A year.
Jeez. Wow.
I was there during the Tet Offensive. It was pretty rough.
Wow. Just wow. And you were drafted?
You bet.
Yeah. Wow. Wow, what a story! Honestly, I'm thrilled, honored to have you. Really, Peter Lemongello, everyone, Frank McKay here. I'm blown away by his story. I knew some of this. This is the first time we're talking since I'm 9 years old, and he would never remember me. I remember him, but he was a heroic figure in the neighborhood just by making himself a star, and just an amazing career. Peter Lemongello.
That's so nice of you, Frank. I do remember your mom and your dad.
Yeah.
And I remember when Bridget was born.
No, that's somebody different. Who's Bridget? That's another family, you think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought that was your sister.
No. My brother, I had a brother growing up, Gordon. I still have a brother like you. He's 2 years older than me, and I was the younger of the two, and we both came over there with our albums. We both bought an album, and we knew you were Long Islander, but we had no idea. When we found out you were around the corner, we were like, what? This is insane. It was mind-blowing because you were like a sensation. Hey, what did you sing on The Tonight Show? What song did you sing?
Oh, I was on 25 times. There's so many.
Oh, were you really? 25 times?
Yes. My God. The song that I'm famous for is Do I Love You. It was a Paul Anka song. That was the theme of the commercial. And so obviously I did that on The Tonight Show and other talk shows. But
25 times. I remember you on Mike Douglas, right? Were you on Merv Griffin?
Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore. And those four, Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore, and The Tonight Show, many times. Total of 35 times.
Do you have copies of all these shows, or some of them just impossible to get?
Impossible to get most of them. We have some. And I have one on one compilation of two Dinah Shore shows that I could send you.
Yeah.
And you might get a kick out of that.
Yeah, just listen. I can't wait to talk to your son. He's got a voice, like an unbelievable voice. How early did you notice in him that he really had it?
He was about 10 when he started this thing around the house.
Yeah.
And you know, I would look at my wife and say, "Karen, do you hear what I hear? Because it sounds like he's really pretty good." And just on his own, very quiet about it, never wanted to know. I mean, he knew what I did, but he never wanted to pattern himself after me or try to emulate me or in any way. He wanted his own style and his own interpretation. And that's what he's done. He's just evolved that way. You know, he's really completely on his own, does his own rehearsal. I help him here and there, but only in the technical sense. You know, I don't try to help him with his style or his approach to songs or anything, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, like any other teenager, well, now he's not a teenager, he's 21 now. But, you know, if people would say, for example, you know, when he'd be interviewed, they would say, obviously you have a famous father. And he'd go, yeah, right. And he would just change the topic completely.
Yeah. Well, listen, but your story, this is a movie. I mean, this isn't a movie of the week type movie. This is a movie. This is a blockbuster. This is an underdog story. But you throw in there Vietnam. I mean, Vietnam. Think about it. Your mom, God bless you, your mom, and God rest her soul, she raised two champs. I mean, really. Yeah. And it was just the two of you, right? It was you and Mike?
Yes.
Wow. Imagine that mother busting with pride. I mean, geez, something happened there, right? I mean, something happened there. That's not just luck. That's not just she had to be very nurturing or positive.
She really encouraged us and did that. You know, it's a typical mother who drove us when I had my rock band. She drove us to the jobs, picked us up. You know, she don't forget we were teenagers. We didn't have cars. We didn't have licenses. You know. She encouraged my brother completely. You know, she always encouraged us, never tried to act like she knew better and you shouldn't do this, you should do that. She was never that way. She always gave us the opportunity to pursue whatever could make us happy, and that's probably why we were so fortunate.
Now, listen, You were lucky to have her. God rest her soul. And listen, we're lucky to have you and your fellow vets in Vietnam. We'll never be able to thank you, and we'll never be able to apologize to all of you for how you were treated when you came back. What a disgraceful, disgraceful moment in history of how.
Yeah, I never know why the American public did that, but.
Shameful. Yeah. Absolutely shameful. Listen, thrilled to have you. Hopefully I can get you for a part two. I got to get your son. It would be absolutely great. But congratulations on just an amazing career. Get this into a movie form. I'm telling you, it's a hit. It's a hit movie.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. And stay well, stay safe, and stay in touch.
Before you go, do you have a website or a social media site?
Yeah, I do. It's peterlemonjello.com. And we have a social media site.
Yeah, you have a Facebook. I know that.
Facebook, yeah. Facebook. And are you a friend on it? If not, we'll make you one.
Yeah, we'll find our way to each other. But that's how I found him. But Peter, thank you very much. Congratulations. Tell your son I can't wait to talk to him, and to everyone out there. Peter Lemongello.
Stay well.
Yeah, stay
thank
well,
you very
Peter.
Much. Bye-bye. And
to everyone. Peter Lemongello has been our very special guest. What a story. I mean, just an incredible story. Just never say die. He got shut out by the industry, and he went at it on his own and went on TV to push his album. Sold 1.8 million records on TV, the first to do that. Just an amazing career, an unknown going on TV. Peter Lemongello has been our very special guest. Frank McKay signing off. We'll see you next time on Breaking It Down.